Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash. With that, you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
So, Versemer here?
Yeah. Right, Pessy.
Pessy. Pessy Vert.
Yeah. Okay. Pessy
here. Hello, I'm Harrison Lewis. I'm about to disembark from the boat that you can probably hear I'm on. We're looking out onto the French coast, it's Normandy to be precise, and we're hoping to get onto one of the beaches used for landing by Allied forces during D-Day. We're going to be doing it in order to recreate one of the most remarkable scientific experiments of the war. By following this route, by retracing these steps, the hope is that we can shine some light on exactly what happened. Now, this extraordinary endeavour wasn't carried out by an individual. Two British commandos were involved. So, I'm not alone. I'm joined by one wetland scientist, Christian Dunn.
Hello, yeah, and what a day we have to get in the water. It is a beautiful sunny day.
What we probably need is a little bit of context. Where are we in this moment and what's going on in the wider world?
Yeah, so you have to put yourself back now to 1943, height of the Second World War. The Allies are preparing for D-Day. Tens, hundreds of thousands of men will be landing here.
From the documents that we can get our hands on, there's one massive glaring issue, and it's the fact that they don't really know what to expect there. They're working off geographical scraps, and that's what the French resistance were able to bring over.
Oh, incredibly. There was four documents in particular which was really interesting to the Allies. It's believed that one of these documents that they smuggled out dated back, now get this, to the Roman era. And the thing that utterly alarmed the Allies was peat. Now, peat, it makes up bogs and fens, are peatlands. Amazing, amazing habitats for many reasons, but not when you're trying to land a vehicle on it.
And it's the potential presence of this peat that's going to result in our two British commandos sitting on a boat, much like this, situated roughly where we are right now, preparing themselves to swim ashore. Now, I've noticed that our skipper, Patrick Ann, has turned the engine off, and it looks as though we're perched just outside of Versemer. I think what we need is a little bit more information on why peat terrified the Allies so much and what was actually going to come through and land on D-Day. Let me grab my phone and we will see what David Woolley, curator and historian of the Tank Museum, has to say.
Let's go for it.
Hi, David. It's Harry from the BBC. How are you doing?
Hello, good morning.
You've been waiting for us.
I'm here. I'm all yours, far away.
That's what we like to hear. We're sort of ready, David. I've noticed that Christian has a better wetsuit than I have, but otherwise we'll be getting in the water quite soon.
You lucky boys. I bet that water temperature's still pretty nippy at this time of year as well.
I mean, everybody that's said anything to us so far has commented on the temperature of the water, haven't they, Christian?
I think people think we're just absolutely mad, to be perfectly honest. And right now, when the sun's down, I'm starting to feel the same myself as well.
David,
what we've spoken about already is the history and the build-up to this moment at the end of 1943, the presence of potentially peat in the area, and also there's some sources that suggest clay. We're trying to figure out why they should be worried.
So if you just take it back just a moment, they've chosen this area of Normandy for very good reasons. They need to land a huge amount of equipment to establish a beachhead very, very quickly. And they know from their experiences earlier at Dieppe in 1942 that they've got a problem there. They're trying to go for a port because the ports tend to be very well defended by the Germans. And of course, first of all as well, will the sand and the underlying rock formations take the weight of things such as a Sherman tank, 30 tons, if you drive that across a beach, is it going to go and sink in the sand? Or, as you've discovered, some geologists are worrying about the presence of blue clay or old peat beds, as they were, in this area.
And you mentioned Dieppe. What happened there?
So we try and take the port of Dieppe, and it becomes a disaster. The German positions are very well defended. We have the problem of trying to land tanks on a chert beach. Large stones, they get caught in the tracks. Vehicles don't even get off the beach. So they start forming units to look at these specific problems. And one of the outcomes of Dieppe is the 79th Armoured Division, under a brilliant commander called Percy Hobart, were going to do specialised armoured vehicles.
Was it true that he was, at the time, a corporal in the Home Guard, and he was brought out of retirement to lead that?
Yeah, it's one of these lovely wartime stories. There's an argument that he may well have had the highest promotion. He goes in a meeting in the War Office as a corporal from the Chipping Campden Home Guard, and he comes out as a Major General, and he's given that challenge. Here is the beaches, here are some of the ideas. We want you to perfect these different bits of machinery to help the guys get ashore. That's where the 79th comes into play, with this amazing range of different types of armoured vehicles, one of which is put together in case that blue clay is found on those beaches.
The two guys that we're researching and following, you've met tons of veterans across your time and you've worked with a lot of different people. You know, what would these guys be thinking?
Yeah, I had the pleasure of interviewing one guy called Ian Hamerton. He was in a flail tank. Basically, when they went ashore, they were aiming to have three tanks in slight echelon. If one got knocked out, the other would take over. If that got knocked out, the other would take over. Whatever happened, they had to get to the seawall. And I asked him the question. I said, what did you think about the fact that you were expendable? And he looked at me quite soberly and he said, you know, we never really thought about it like that at the time. They were told if D-Day fails, that means all those German troops, all those tanks based in the West could head off to the Eastern Front, which means that actually suddenly that Red Army is going to have a very different situation in front of it. It may even have led to the first atomic bomb being dropped on Berlin, not Japan. For those two guys going ashore, you know, to put it bluntly, no pressure then. You've just got to make sure, lads, that these beaches are going to be up to it. Otherwise, we might not do the D-Day landings in the way we want to.
Incredibly hard to imagine.
Good luck. I hope it all goes well and it's not too cold.
Us too. Thanks ever so much.
Thank you, David.
Right, OK, where are we? So, listening to David, we know that the landings have to happen at Normandy, but if peat and clay are present, they're going to grind this invasion to a halt. The Allies are genuinely facing a real crisis here.
Without a doubt. I mean, if they land and they get stuck, well, that's the end of D-Day. They're sitting ducks for the armour that the Germans have just there, literally just there.
So we're still sort of stuck in this limbo. That's until it falls at the feet of one Lieutenant Nigel Clogston Wilmot. And he's a special character.
Very much so, yes. He had understood, unlike many other people, really, the importance of getting boots on the ground, as it were, before an amphibious landing happens.
And in the run-up to D-Day, what we see is that Wilmot's actually given his own unit.
Yeah, he creates the Combined Operations Pilotage Parties. He swims out to various beaches, which the Allies at the time are thinking about landing on, and they go to look for defences, they go for check for mining, but they are going to actually look at the soil substrate as well. They are soil scientists. They are taking samples of soil when they land.
For those of you who aren't squeezing into a wetsuit, you need to imagine. Imagine it's 1943, and if there ever was a time to strike, it's right now, and it has to work first time. Everybody knows, and the Allies are keenly aware, that they can't win anything. They can't win any war without getting an army onto European soil. And in this moment, partly because of one ancient map, partly due to the scepticism of one man, everything's in the balance. A lot is going to rest on Wilmot's theory of testing the soil, trusting science to tell them what will happen to the men and machines that are sent over. Wilmot himself isn't well enough to swim, we know that. So the two men who are going to make the trip on the 31st of December 1943, that's New Year's Eve, are Logan Scott Bowden and Bruce Ogden Smith. Their job is going to be to swim to the shore, carry out a series of observations which they hope will one way or another demonstrate whether the D-Day landings can go ahead as planned. Christian and I, we're going to try and recreate this, what was called Operation KJH, and we're going to swim onto the beach, codenamed Gold, that's stretched out just in front of us, in front of the town of Versailles, gather some of the soil samples, as Ogden Smith and Bowden would have. But first, there is somebody on the boat that we haven't introduced. Claire Lusson, historian. Firstly, I mean, do you think that Christian and myself might be a little bit mad?
Considering the heat of the water, I'm not sure we'll do that.
I don't think heat is the best word to use there.
Or cold of the water.
Claire, it's a fascinating story, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely amazing.
It wouldn't have looked like it does now. This town, Versailles, would have been quite different.
Yeah, Versailles was a little smaller at the time, and it was far more defended than what we can currently see in front of us.
Right, so how many men would be here stationed looking out right now?
Well, the number of Germans along the Normandy coast that night was not that huge. Maybe a little less than 100 were present.
Just 100 men?
Okay. Yeah.
Wilmot had specifically chosen New Year's Eve because he was hoping that, first of all, there'd be less people, and secondly, people might be celebrating, let us say.
Yeah, well, the number was not especially different of the other days. Along this stretch of Normandy, the number of German that was deployed was really smaller than in many other locations. Even on D-Day itself, a few months later, it's evaluated that, generally speaking, next to the coast, the number of Germans was around 35,000, so that's not really like a big number.
Mm. I mean, I've managed to find and bring along a picture of what I think the beach defences might have looked like, a map. Yeah, what does this tell us?
This one is good because this is the location which is probably to be flooded and which is very often flooded in the winter.
So right behind the beach,
yeah,
there's a big stretch on Gold,
yeah,
where they'll be marked.
Of course, something which may be an issue as well for the forces invading on June 6, 1944.
And you can see here as well that the red marks, they're indicating guns, placements.
Yeah, well, they used to have in that German strong point, which is in front of us, one piece of 50 millimeters, one piece of 75 and one piece of 88, which is usually what the veterans were used to tell were the most dangerous weapons, because the 88 was a very accurate weapon. Add on top of that, that in some of these German fortifications, the Germans had some big lights and spots that were used to illuminate the whole coastline by night, meaning that it was not pitch black.
The armies that were stationed here, do we know what kind of experience they have? Do we know what the feeling is around Normandy? The general assumption is there was no expectation that there was going to be an invasion here.
Yeah. In terms of the quality and age, a lot of soldiers were present along that portion of the coast where about 35 to 45 part of the German forces were present that day, where a specific unit which had been returned by the Germans from the eastern countries. Even the Germans were fearing them.
Right, okay, gosh. One thing that always gets me about these two commandos is that, if I'm right, Hitler had given the order that if commandos were found, they were to be shot.
Yeah.
They weren't to be taken as prisoners of war.
Since the year 1942 and the first Allied Forces commandos heading along the coast, unfortunately, most of the ones who were captured were killed straight on the way by the Germans.
So if these two chaps, they got to the land, and if things had gone wrong and they'd been captured, they weren't going to be sent to a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah, well, it would have been obvious that they would have been killed.
How important do you think this mission was?
I think it was extremely important. Without that mission, the only reliable informations were only the maps the Allied forces were having, which were either provided by military intelligence services or the French resistance. That's meaning that they didn't have those technical pieces, which were so, so important for the bringing of all the logistics and the supplies and the military vehicles, which were going to be parts.
Claire, I could talk to you all day about all this. I really could. I find it fascinating.
Saying that, I think it's time to finally kit up and get in the water.
Yeah, indeed. I think you need to blow up your armbands as well, don't you?
Yeah, I'm hoping we'll drift in a little closer to shore by the time I manage to actually zip up my suit.
Right.
Got to cover on that one.
There you go.
Thank you.
Okay, that's wetsuit. Let's attach those mics.
Yeah, you happy with that?
Couldn't be happier.
Okay, Christian, there is nothing for it. Ogden Smith and Scott Belden would have swam to shore on the night of New Year's Eve 1943 in search of Pete. Their reconnaissance would have determined whether or not all of that effort, all of that planning that's gone into D-Day was worthwhile. There's only one way to be certain of what they found, and that's to follow suit. So we need to get in the water and swim the 300 metres to the beach. Wish us luck.
Here we go. Gosh.
D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress.
Well, now Germans are dive bombing a convoy out into sea. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
There he goes, smash! There was only one man got out by parachute, so presumably there was only a crew of one in it.
The paratroops are landing. They're landing all around me as I speak. They've come in from the sea and they're fluttering down.
I have this message for all of you.
And they're just about the best thing that we've seen for a good many
Although hours. The initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching.
We know we're there now.
It's just a couple more steps. Christian, that's it.
It was absolutely fantastic.
This is where Ogden Smith, Scott Bowden, they would have been here 80 years ago.
And that boat, our boat there, that's pretty much where their boat would have been as well. This is it. This is exactly what they did.
We know that the site they're trying to get to carry out these experiments is actually on the opposite side of the village.
We swam, but we also got taken by the currents, exactly like they did as well.
I put together a pinpoint location on what three words, you know, using modern technology as you do, and come up with where I think roughly the site that they were heading for is. I mean, if we hang around here, we're probably going to get quite cold. So shall we take a walk, try and get ourselves there, and maybe along the way take a change of clothes for comfort?
I think that's a really good idea, and it will be great to actually get to that spot.
We've walked the entire length of the village and now we're further to the west. But it's pretty intimidating to think that these guys would have been literally under the noses of occupied Versailles.
Exactly, and we were, you know, having a nice stroll. We weren't having to hit the deck every 60 seconds, whereas the light from the lighthouse swept over us.
And as you say that, we come to the coordinates that I punched in.
Yeah.
This is where I think the guys are trying to get to. So that colossal effort that's been made to try and get Ogden Smith, Scott Bowden, to this exact point, this has been achieved.
But then what they have to do is wetland, soil, science, right here, right now. That's what they're going to be doing.
Suddenly you perk up again.
I'm always perky, but as soon as you mention soil, science and wetlands, oh my goodness me, it's all my Christmas has come at once.
Ogden Smith and Scott Bowden wouldn't have hung around. How do we go about doing the same thing?
We will be doing it in exactly the same way as they did, which is exactly the same way as my students from Bangor University would do this. We are going to take a transect, a straight line, and every so often, every regular interval, we are going to take a sample.
I know the answer to this, but what do we need?
We need one of these. I'm proudly holding it in my hand. This has been made for me by basically the Rolex of auger makers, if you can imagine such a thing. Royal Eichelkamp have made this for me by the directions that I gave them, which I managed to glean from the different sources which we've been reading.
And what it does is take core samples.
Yeah, a tube, basically, of substrate, of soil.
Right, let's get going. We're going to start roughly here?
Yeah, this is where they would start. You know, we're right at the top of the beach. So, here we go. We've got our auger, our corer. And what you're going to do is just push it in. It's nice sharpened at the tip. Plunge it in all the way. Twist it gently. And then we're going to try and pull it out. And as you can see, it's coming out here. Perfect. There is literally no peat, no mud, no clay at the bottom. It's just sand for at least 12 inches down. That is good.
I mean, this is going to sound daft, but I know this is your day job. So I'm going to ask anyway. I'd know the difference between what I'm looking at, wouldn't I?
You would, yes. And I think this is what, again, is so interesting, because even in the dark, what you can do is you feel it, and you can feel it yourself. So this feels gritty, okay? It's sand. It's very clearly sand. If we get further down and we find some peat, you'll feel the difference. It won't be gritty in your fingers. It'll feel smooth. And if there's, like, silt as well, that'll feel kind of, like, soapy.
Christian, I still think there's quite a few more samples to do here, isn't there?
I know, and I can see you're speeding me up. So what we're going to do is do a little bit by eye now. And we can see, if you're just looking out here, some sites, some areas look different. And they're the ones that I'm interested in. See that one there, just there? It's darker, slightly raised. That could be a site of clay or peat there. That's what we want to look at.
All right, time to do it. Time to get stuck in.
Let's go for it. Ready? So, that's good as well. Yeah, good sound. Look at that. I'm glad my auger is nice and sharp. Oh, well, went easy. Sand.
What if you just took one here?
Here?
Yeah.
Let's do it here. Oh, look at this. We got it. Look at that.
That's it. That's what we're looking for.
Generally, yeah.
How do you know?
Okay, so we've got sand here right at the top. But look at this bit in the middle. Okay, it's much darker. Peat is just organic matter. It's just dead plants. That's what makes it so soft, so rubbish, if you're trying to drive a vehicle over it. And then you've got the soft clay as well. I mean, as a wetland scientist, this is fantastic. I mean, this is what I want. But if I'm, you know, if I'm organising an invasion of Europe, this is not what I want.
It's been an adventure, hasn't it?
It's been a roller coaster of a day.
There is, I think, just to round everything off, one quite special place I'd like to take you.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
I've brought us to the British Normandy Memorial, which has these two big arches in the marble that look out over the sea and the beach. There is something about this spot, isn't there?
Oh, my goodness me, yeah. You can certainly feel the hairs on the back of your neck standing up. I mean, we're overlooking Gold Beach. You can see where we just were, where we took our samples and where our commandos did that. That's what they did. We were there.
I've partly done this as well because I didn't fancy getting back in the water. They did have to get back in the water.
They did indeed, and in many ways that was probably the toughest part of their entire mission, because they would have to swim out 300-400 yards, and then all they had to signal was a torch.
They got rebuffed from the breakers twice before they were finally able, probably exhausted, to push through and get on the boat and take those samples back to the UK for analysis. And this isn't going to be the last time that they're at the shores of Normandy.
For our two commandos, we think they did around about 30. When they were interviewed after the war, they said they couldn't remember how many missions that they actually did. They were also having to land on other beaches as well, just in case they got captured. And then if they got questioned, they wouldn't be able to give away what were the desired landing beaches.
After the multiple swims, after the surveys and observations, what do they find out about the site we're looking over right now?
So they find peace. As we did, they found evidence that if you landed certain vehicles on here, you were going to sink. And so that meant that the Allies could specifically choose the actual landing areas of this beach to make it as safe as possible for everything coming on shore.
Stood here looking over the site, maybe it's nice just to take a moment to appreciate what did happen and those names that are etched in the marble.
Couldn't agree with you more. I mean, two things have really stood out from this, and that is, if my area of obscure science can do that, what other areas of obscure science were involved in the war itself? And the second thing is just the bravery of these guys. I mean, we swam, we had a few butterflies just before we did it, and if things had gone wrong, you know, we were most certainly not going to get shot. So the bravery of these guys is just astounding.
There's one thing that I'll take home, and it's this anticipation before you get to these sort of sites and before you get onto Normandy. I mean, my grandfather came in on the fifth day, and so I have this expectation of what I should feel. You don't really see traces of the war. You see life going on as was before and as will be across most of Europe. And there's something quite inspiring about seeing freedom and seeing normality resumed.
Yeah, 100%, that's what freedom means, being able to get on with your life. So isn't it wonderful that kids are out there now flying kites?
For Ogden Smith and Scott Bowden, 5 months from this day, the world will see the greatest land invasion it's ever witnessed. And it will be possible, really, due to them.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.